Almost 20 years ago, on February the 11th, 1990, Nelson Mandela emerged from prison to greet a massive crowd and a watching world.
Amandla! Amandla! E Africa! Aibu! Yes!
This was Mandela's first public speech in almost three decades. And though we were all waiting to hear what he was planning to do next...
I salute the African National Congress.
He insisted first on thanking those who'd stood by him during his imprisonment.
Comrade Oliver Tambo.
As well as organisations such as the ANC and the South African Communist Party, which he said had survived 40 years of unrelenting persecution.
I salute General Secretary Joe Slovo. One of our finest patriots.
Joe Slovo, Comrade Joe, is our subject on Great Lives today. He was born in Lithuania in 1926 and died just 5 years after Mandela's release in 1995. It's said that tens of thousands of mourners lined the route to his final place of rest in a cemetery in Soweto, an extraordinary tribute for a white man in South Africa. My guest who's chosen him is David Miliband, and I really don't think a potted CV is needed. Our Foreign Secretary, the youngest for 30 years, he was head of Tony Blair's policy unit, MP for South Shields since 2001, and before that, well, maybe some of that will emerge. But first, his choice of great life. David Miliband, what has drawn you into choosing Joe?
First, I think that anyone who goes from being a 10-year-old Yiddish-speaking Lithuanian refugee to a hero for tens of thousands of South Africans at the heart of a defining liberation struggle is indeed a great life. Great lives aren't always the great lives of people who are presidents and prime ministers and kings and queens. They are extraordinary people who emerge from ordinary backgrounds. The second reason is more personal, because as a A-level student in 1983, revising for my exams in North London, I remember that at 5 or 6 o'clock on a spring day in 1983, the doorbell rang. Standing there was Joe Slovo, the chief of staff of the armed wing of the ANC, and he dropped in.
Why was he there? Why was he in your house?
He'd come to see my parents. He'd dropped in on my parents. They had got to know my parents in London in the 1960s. For obvious reasons, he didn't have long-laid plans and didn't warn people about his movements because he was a marked man. His wife had been tragically assassinated the year before, but he was there for a family connection.
Did you already know exactly who he was and know all about him when you met him?
I didn't know all about him, no. I knew he was the head of the armed wing of the ANC. What I didn't know was the extent to which he was such a popular hero in South Africa and actually throughout Africa.
Do you think one of the reasons you were drawn to him was, at least on paper, some shared elements in your background, both Jewish, both Marxist, both originally from abroad?
In terms of my father,
yes.
I do remember that my father and Joe Slovo would speak fragments of Yiddish together. Yiddish was one of my dad's first languages. And so I think that there must be some link there. And one of the things that I think Joe Slovo, I imagine he said to me, or I'd like to think he said to me, was that the struggle that he was engaged in South Africa was a struggle that did need people who weren't black South Africans to stand for it. It required Lithuanian, exiled, fleeing, persecuted Jews to stand up for what's right.
Do you go to synagogue, David Miliband?
No, I don't. No.
Are you entirely secular?
Yes, I think I am. My parents were secular, and the grandparents that I knew were secular as well.
Does it make you feel any less Jewish?
In some ways, it must do, because Judaism is a religion, as well as a culture.
Mm.
But I'm not a believer. I'm not practising.
Before we introduce our expert guest, I just want to play another clip, this time of Joe himself, talking here about what was perhaps the most important decision of his life, the decision he took, along with Mandela, to use violent means to achieve their goal.
He did agonise, and the whole movement agonised, because we must remember we had come from 50 years... of a philosophical approach to struggle which approximated very closely to Mahatma Gandhi's Satyagraha, passive defiance. And all of us were, in a very real way, steeped in this kind of political approach. And therefore, it wasn't a simple matter of overnight just choosing one option rather than the other. It was a sort of, in the real sense of the term, an option of last resort, and did cause a great deal of agonizing.
Do you recognize that voice? What do you hear in it?
Oh, the voice is very, very striking. I mean, I haven't heard that voice, you know, for 20 years, probably. It's not a ranting political leader. It's so thoughtful, and each word carefully chosen. You know, when you think of armed struggle, you think of someone with a machine gun. It was a soft voice, and so it's very moving to hear that.
With us, we have one of Joe's three daughters, Gillian Slobo, a best-selling novelist and author also of a family memoir called Every Secret Thing. It reveals in detail what it's like to be born to parents utterly committed to a single cause. Gillian, your father once wrote of the traumas his three children must have been facing, but that, he said, my optimism and euphoria about the pace of struggle made us less aware of our own future and that of our children. Slightly chilling.
I just read his autobiography again, his unfinished memoir, and one of the things that always makes me laugh when I read that is that he has a chapter which is called Mass Protest, Ideology and Family Life. And when I read, I mean, it makes me laugh rather than feel chilled, because actually Joe was an incredibly warm person. He was a archetypal joke-cracking Jewish, peanut-eating, whiskey-swilling Jew who had a tremendous amount of bonhomie and a tremendous amount of warmth, but who also recognised that the choices he made in his life meant that he wasn't the father around for the family that other fathers might have been.
How did your parents end up there, Gillian, in South Africa?
My mother was actually born there. She was also the daughter of immigrants, but they had come the generation before. And my father, who was born in Lithuania and who was Yiddish-speaking as his mother tongue, his father, when my father was two, basically, he was an economic migrant. He went to make a better life, and he went to Argentina. And just before he was about to send for his family, he lost his job, took the first boat, and ended up in South Africa. And there are people who talk about when Joe arrived in the station, he'd had his hair shorn against lice, and he was carrying a paper bag full of rotten fruit. That's all he had with him.
And his father was working as a street vendor of fruit and vegetables, I think, wasn't he?
Yes, and then he went to work in a bakery, and then he started his own vegetable shop. He didn't really manage very well, his father, and soon after they were there, his mother became pregnant again, and she died in childbirth.
I've sometimes thought, David, I was in politics too, and enjoyed a childhood in which there was never any worry about where the next meal was coming from, or if there was, my father did all the worrying for us. We never noticed it as children. How can we entirely understand what it's all about if our own lives have been as easy as they have?
We can't. If you look back to the governments, even in this country, even in a relatively secure Britain of the 60s and 70s, the people who populated those governments had fought in wars that defined the 20th century, and we are the lucky generation. I think we can have strong views, we can bring great passions, I think there are great causes, but you're right that the life experience is much, much, much more comfortable.
Although, actually, I think Joe would disagree with you, and certainly he was insufferable towards his last year because he had a cancer that was going to kill him. But he was insufferable in the sense that he kept saying, yes, it's terrible that I'm dying at this point, but also, I am the luckiest person alive because I helped change the world. And I think that generation, and certainly those South Africans, really had a feeling that they had worked for a cause and they had won. Quite a hard act to follow, that generation, I think.
When and how did he meet Nelson Mandela?
I think he met him in university, first of all. They were both lawyers. I mean, Joe, who had left school at 14, went into the army, and because he was an ex-serviceman, was then able to get a scholarship to go to university, and so they were students together. And they were all part of that same network that was trying to change what was happening in South Africa, although in different organizations. But actually, I think for him, it started even earlier. He had a teacher at school for the few years that he was in school who was an Irish anti-imperialist, very anti-British, who took him to meetings. And Joe once described to me that one of the turning points for him is that he went to a socialist meeting about some subject or other and found himself sitting next to a black man and spent the whole time thinking to himself, aren't I wonderful? I am sitting next to a black man. Isn't it great? I'm sitting next to a black man. And when he came out, said to himself, what kind of world is this that you can't concentrate on the speaker because you're so amazed you're sitting next to a black man? And I think that was a transformative moment for him.
I wonder whether the fact that he never really knew his father, his mother died in childbirth, that circumstances of his childhood were, if not rootless, at least extremely disorienting. I wonder whether he fixed himself onto a very certain ideology of history and the world, partly as a means of anchoring and securing himself. Why such a fervent communist?
People fix on ideology for answers. It must have seemed to present an answer. There was a binary struggle that was going on, and communism seemed to offer a binary answer. And I think that Julian will be able to say better than I that Joe Slovo was pretty doctrinaire as well as passionate in his politics.
Although I think there was something different operating in South Africa, actually. By the time Joe was involved in politics, the African National Congress, the ANC, Mandela's organisation, was a black-only organisation. If you are white and you wanted to be anti-apartheid, one of the only places that you could go that would organise and was prepared to work with black people was, in fact, the Communist Party. Liberal South Africans didn't do that. It was the natural way to go.
That's a much better answer. You should use that rather than my answer. That's a miles better answer. That's absolutely right. Because we're in danger of imposing a sort of European view of what the word communist means onto a continent and a country that was completely different.
And I think for most South African communists, the issue was not Stalin. It was not the polarization of the world. It was what was happening in South Africa and how to change South Africa. And it happened, and we have to also acknowledge that the West shored up the apartheid regime and the Soviet Union supported the ANC.
And your father went to prison.
He went to prison during the treason trial. It doesn't read as very onerous, actually, because since he was white, he had a much better treatment than the black prisoners. I mean, they had mattresses, the black prisoners just had the floor. But they still felt that they could change the country and they could change it peacefully. I mean, you know, the defiance campaign where people went out and defied the apartheid laws and the Freedom Charter were wonderful times of togetherness for them. And I think they had a tremendous hope that by using this kind of pressure, they could turn the apartheid and the nationalist government away from its path. It didn't prove that way.
You're listening to Great Lives, and David Miliband is championing the South African anti-apartheid activist Joe Slovo. Also with us is Joe's daughter, Gillian. Gillian, you've said it didn't work out that way. Sharpeville, what was that?
Sharpeville was a group of people organised by the Pan-African Congress went to a police station as part of a campaign against the pass laws. Every black person had to carry a pass law which would give them permission to live where they were living and to work where they were working. And this group of unarmed people marched on a police station in Sharpeville in order to make a bonfire of their passes. And I think what happened is one of the policemen panicked and opened fire, at which point the whole troop did. And by the time it was over, I think 56 people were dead. The government declared a state of emergency and arrested almost every activist they could and jailed them. My father was picked up in the first swoop. My mother went to Swaziland with us to escape being picked up. And I think that was the time when people in the movement began to realize that it didn't matter what they did. The government would respond with more and more brutality, and maybe the time had come to pick up the gun.
Is there, David Miliband, are there circumstances in which violent reaction, terrorism, is the right response?
That's such a hard question. Right has to be judged in two ways, doesn't it? Whether it's justifiable and whether it's effective.
Mm.
I think I'm right in saying that one of the ways in which the ANC tried to square the circle between being a movement of political change and a movement that used violence was to target installations rather than people. The most famous ANC military attack was on the Sasol oil refinery in 1980, and that was perceived to be a remarkable blow at the heart of the South African regime. But I think that the answer to your question has to be, yes, there are circumstances in which it's justifiable, and yes, there are circumstances in which it is effective, but it is never effective on its own.
Because you have chosen as your great life someone who helped spearhead a terrorist movement.
Well, he joined the South African Communist Party and then became the head of a terrorist movement. And I think that the importance for me is that the South African example proved something remarkable, because it looked like a regime that would last forever.
Mm.
And it was blown down in the end.
But
I have to take issue with the two of you on the use of your word terrorist here. I think that is the modern usage where anybody is classified as a terrorist, no matter what they're doing. I certainly think it was true that in the years of Nkomtiwe Siwe, the ANC's army, certainly nobody in the Labour Party would ever have described them as terrorists.
Right.
They would have described them as what they were, which was a guerrilla army. A guerrilla army fighting an armed struggle, a liberation army.
Well, all terrorists call themselves that.
And, well, what is your definition of terrorism?
Someone who uses terror as a means of pursuing political ends.
So would you call the Bush administration a terrorist organization for going into Iraq? Because they certainly did use terror to pursue political ends, but we don't call them terrorists, do we?
Here's Joe himself writing about how to use explosives. We'd learnt that permanganate of potash mixed with an aluminium powder and catalyzed by a drop of acid could make an effective explosion. For timing devices, we had to experiment with various thicknesses of paper and cardboard to establish the time it took for the acid to eat through. I'm actually almost alone, I think, not attacking terrorism. I think terrorism can be a legitimate means of pursuing a legitimate goal. But if that isn't terrorism, what is it?
I would dispute the word terrorism. They were in a phase of what was called armed propaganda. And what they were doing was...
Armed propaganda?
Yeah, in the sense that they were actually did not have the strength to fight a war against this enormously powerful army. And what they did was try to blow up significant buildings when they were empty, railway lines when there was no train on them, and also telegraph lines, telephone wires, and etc.
Joe and your mother argued constantly about the right means to achieve what they agreed was the end. What was her position? How did she differ from him?
Her position was that the ANC should spend more time and more resources into trying to stir up the mass mobilization of people in South Africa. I mean, And probably less time on guns.
And which of them, David Miliband, Joe or Ruth, would you have supported in that argument?
I think that I'm more of a political person. I think it's hard to argue, though, that on its own a political struggle would have delivered. I think that what Gillian has said about the striking at the heart of a regime's claim to a monopoly on power, which the ANC armed wing represented, was very significant. And I think it also brought home a very, very important thing in all of politics, which is that patience can be played on both sides of every political struggle. And there's no question that people in the regime must have been asking themselves whether or not the opposition would melt away eventually. And what I think is the most remarkable part of a remarkable story is that the people who seemed most committed were the people who led the compromise. I mean, who would have thought that F.W. de Klerk would be the man who made the change? Who would have thought that after all the bloodshed and all the repression, it would have been Mandela and Slovo who were the people who said, we've got to find a way to live together and we've got to have the sort of sunset clauses, the reconciliation. I mean, reconciliation with people who've killed your comrades and your relatives.
You're making the case for talking to the Taliban quite strongly here.
As it happens, the vast majority of Taliban are going to have to be part of the political system in Afghanistan, and any attempt to argue that the way forward in Afghanistan is to kill all the quote-unquote Taliban is simply wrong. And I've said that publicly again and again and again, because the vast bulk of Taliban are actually people rented or hired or contingently bullied into supporting an insurgency. And actually, our job in Afghanistan is to give them a secure future in the political system. But that's a different question.
Tell us, Gillian, about the circumstance of your mother's death.
My mother was living in Maputo in Mozambique. My father was living there with my mother. And my mother one day went into work and opened an envelope that had been sent to her and contained a bomb, and it blew up, killing her instantly in 1982.
Who had made the bomb?
Well, we now know who had made the bomb, because they applied for amnesty for her murder. So two South African policemen, one called Jerry Raven, who's what they call in South Africa an explosive expert, i.e. a bomb maker, and the other one, a policeman called Craig Williamson.
I remember the day after Ruth First's assassination as if it was yesterday. I came down, and it was 1982, and on the front page of the newspaper was the news of Ruth First's assassination, and my mother was in tears because she knew her very, very well indeed. And I think that a lot of people must have been asking, are we ever going to be able to overwhelm this regime?
Joe Slover returned to South Africa from Mozambique in 1990, after almost three decades in exile. Before we move on to his final years, I just want to hear three voices from that time.
When I was a student in the 80s and being a member of the AZASO, which was the Students' Congress, I mean, he was one of the people we sort of worshipped. We thought they were going to come marching down to Pretoria to liberate all of us.
Joe Slovo was not a white liberal. He was a freedom fighter. And that is why he was so popular in the townships. He was fighting for their freedom and his freedom as a South African.
Mandela, at the ANC National Conference in December, put it very nicely. He said of Slovo that, "I'm sure, Comrade Joe, you never thought of yourself as white. You thought of yourself as a South African. And yet you've done an enormous amount by being white in the struggle for the cause of non-racialism in our country."
Joe Slovo was this example of a white person who is as worthy of your worship as all the others, like Oliver Tambo, that he was with in exile, actually. He made non-racialism alive that way.
That was Lizeka Mda, Milton Nkosi, and Jeremy Cronin, a colleague of Slovo's in the South African Communist Party. David Miliband, how much importance should we place, do you think, on Joe Slovo's whiteness in assessing his centrality to the campaign?
I think that must be an important thing. When you see the tens of thousands of people, black people, at his funeral, but more to the point, when you see him at the rallies with Mandela in 1990,
yeah,
he was the leading white supporter and leader of the liberation movement. But I think that what has come through this conversation is a commitment to people that doesn't reflect, first of all, on the most obvious thing about them, which is what colour they are. And I think that the comment that we've just heard that said it was his South Africanness and his passion for justice, not his whiteness, that defined him, is almost the ultimate testimony that you'd want for any life, that you've actually been able to show the content of your character, overcome, if you like, the colour of your skin, to quote Martin Luther King.
Well, I think also there is something about him being white which made a difference, and I think it in two ways. One is the fact that the ANC did have white leaders, and he wasn't the only one, and did have white people who put their lives on the line. Brom Fisher, who died in prison, Harold Wolpe, who managed to escape. There were significant leaders, Albie Sachs, who was blown up. And I think it helped contribute to the lack of vengeance that happened when the turn came. And the other thing is, I just remember when Joe first went back to South Africa and I went with him, he was always being approached by people. And at one time we were in a restaurant and this white man came up to him, practically crying, and said, "I want to thank you for what you've done, because you've shown South Africa that not all white people are as cowardly as I have been."
Brilliant answer.
Oh, thank you.
That is so powerful.
Joe Slovo died in 1995, by which time He was housing minister in the new South African government, Gillian.
Yes. I think it was as much a surprise to him as to everybody else. And it was certainly a great surprise to the Department of Housing when this man who had been called nicely in the South African papers the teddy bear terrorist and called some other much ruder things turned out to be a housing minister. And in the short time that he was there, quite a successful housing minister, because the first thing he did was actually start talking to business about putting money into public housing, which is not something that anybody expected a communist to do.
So he turned into a sort of new Labour character at the end, did he, David?
I think one has to be careful in claiming Joe Slovo for the new Labour big tent.
Yeah, I think one does have to be.
But the triumph of politics, he was the least likely person to be luxuriating in the back seat of a ministerial car or in a large ministerial office. But what he'd been fighting for 50 or 60 years was actually decency for people irrespective of the colour of their skin. And you know, housing is one of the most basic needs. And I think it was an inspired appointment, actually, even for a few short months, to put someone in there who could bring the dedication and devotion of a lifetime's commitment to actually making something very basic better for people.
Tell me about his funeral.
He died in January 1995.
And he was sick with cancer for some years before he died.
He had multiple myeloma, which was, as soon as it was diagnosed, he knew he was going to die within the next 2 years, and he did. And we had a committee to do his funeral, which included very many of the new ministers in the government. And we all sat around and they asked us, where do you want to have it? And we said the Johannesburg City Hall, because that was a place that Joe liked to go to. He loved to listen to classical music there. And they very gently said to us, we think it may not be big enough. And we ended up having his funeral ceremony in Alexander Stadium in Soweto, which I don't know holds 100,000. The place was absolutely packed. The mourners, and I think there were tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, were almost entirely black and had come to celebrate the life of this man. Joe had, as is traditionally for Jews, a very simple wooden coffin. And for about 6 months after that, it was remarkable that black people who were buried, who used to spend an absolute fortune on the coffin, money that they couldn't afford, started going into fashion and using a Joe Slovo coffin. So I think that is a legacy that Joe would have been proud of.
My thanks to David Miliband, who chose Joe Slovo as his great life, and to Joe's daughter, Gillian. Goodbye.